Hello and welcome to Jets Energy Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Rita Louise, and thank you all for tuning into the show today. Wow, do we have like a diverse lineup. In the first hour, we're going to be speaking with Stephen Sakaloris about reincarnation. And in the second hour, we have Jesse Ventura talking about politics. Reincarnation, politics, don't know how they fit together, but I'm sure there's some big cosmic plan for it all. But don't forget, Jets Energy Radio is brought to you by SoulHealer.com and the Institute of Applied Energetics. That's www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com. You can also catch all of our archives at the Jets Energy Radio website. That's www.jetsenergyradio.com. And you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter that will keep you informed of all the guests that will be coming up on the show. And in the last 6 months, we have started to YouTube the different shows that we have. And so, you know, you can listen to them in your car, streaming over your phone, you know, because, you know, hands-free, listen to the show, hang out with me. That sounds like fun. I think it would be fun. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit about Stephen and get him on the air. Stephen Sakaloris is the producer of a documentary called In Another Life, Reincarnation in America. He's written two books just recently released. Matthew Franklin Whitaker, in his own words, is a scholarly attempt to prove his own reincarnation case. Stephen has a master's degree in counseling, has studied reincarnation for 38 years, and has one of the most extensive websites on the topic of reincarnation in the world. His website is www.iaal.golden. Okay, this is a little challenging one. IAL.goldthread.com. Whew, Stephen, that one was a hard one. Anyway, please welcome to Jets Energy Radio, Stephen Sakaloris. Hey, Stephen, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for inviting me.
See, only sort of awful, but anyway, you're here now, and I got your website out, and maybe by the end of the show I can say it right. Gold Thread. Gold
Thread.
Yeah,
I think Golden Thread was taken or something. I don't remember how I ended up with Gold Thread.
Well, I mean, I understand the concept, or I'm assuming kind of like the silver cord, gold thread.
Exactly.
Kind
that
of?
Was actually my, that was my video business, and then the IAL, it stands for In Another Life, that was tacked onto the end of it, and that so that became a whole separate entity in itself. But Gold Thread was my company name.
Got it. How did you get interested in the whole concept of reincarnation in the first place?
Well, I'd studied it since about age 19 when I started studying the scriptures of different world religions and some of the major mystics of more recent times. And I just accepted it as part of the whole package. I really, from the time right off out of high school that I studied the Bhagavad Gita, I remember just accepting it instantly. But it was when I started my documentary around 1997 that I really started to investigate it and realized that people in Western cultures had been investigating it, including scientifically, for some time. So that's when I became aware of things like past life therapy and Dr. Ian Stevenson's research and some of the hypnotic-based research. And that's when I really started delving into it.
There was a comment in the chat room if you could speak up a little bit, so maybe talk
yeah.
into the mic a little better.
Yeah, there we go. Okay.
Okay. All right, there was a question in there. You know, the idea of reincarnation in the Western world is really overlooked by a lot of people. I mean, we come from such a Christian upbringing in the general sense that there is the generalized belief that, you know, you're born, you die, and when you die, you go to heaven, versus the concept of being born again.
What I found is it's a very strange dichotomy between what people actually believe and what we're officially supposed to believe. And that's really where the documentary came from, because if you look at the Gallup poll, first of all, almost one quarter of the population says they believe in reincarnation, which you would never know from, you know, walking around talking to people. But if you sit down to lunch with three other people, chances are one of you believes in reincarnation. It's that, you know, common. And also, something I think is important to point out and that I found out in my research is a lot of people are having experiences. On my website, there's a whole couple pages worth of people's experiences that they've sent in, and my website isn't the only one that's got little stories. So people are having experiences of, you know, they're driving along and they go across a bridge and their two-year-old daughter says, that's where I drowned, you know, or when I was big, I, you know, used to change your diapers or whatever, you know, it goes on and on. This is not so uncommon, but it's very much suppressed in society for some reason.
Based on your research, what is the cycle? You know, is it as simple as it sounds? We're born, we live, we die, we do something, and then we come back again? I mean, is it really that simple, or is there more steps to it that we're really not aware of?
Well, of course, you can delve into something as far as you want to delve into it. And, you know, if you start getting into karma, it gets even more complicated. But that's the basics. And what I found is it's very natural. The life cycle is very natural. The lifespan is the linear way to look at it. It's an unnatural way to look at it. But if you look at all of life as in cycles, now at the introduction of your show, the introduction talks about vibrational cycles, that everything is in waves and cycles. So this is just the natural, you know, way that life is. And birth, you know, can be natural. Death can be natural. Being reborn can be natural. But we make it unnatural, I would say, in terms of the things that we throw into the mix, including materialism, for example, the belief that this is all there is, and linear thinking that things have a, you know, a beginning and an ending and that's it. You know, then we make everything unnatural. But the natural course of life is all of these cycles that just, you know, are harmonious.
And I think a lot of people don't, like, I've heard people say that, because I do ghost hunting and I talk about ghosts and I talk about, you know, life beyond death, you know, for more from a ghost perspective as opposed to a, you know, life after life perspective. Mm-hmm. And I've had people say, but there can't be ghosts, you know, ghosts that are people, because when you die, you go to heaven. And I just am like, okay, but it sure did look like Aunt Sally standing there, not some demon. Anyway, one of the things, why I was bringing up these cycles, one of the things that you talked about or was talked about in the video was something about like going through a life review process or seeing your life. Do you have any information that you could share? Because I find that aspect just so important to understanding the, you know, the cycle that we go through. Because I think everybody gets the part where we're here, but don't really have an understanding of what it is thought happens when we go on the other side.
The life review is one of the most common elements that's described and most consistent. It's very much described the same way in all the literature and all the accounts that I've read. And it happens apparently fairly soon after you die. It's one of the first pieces of business. You know, that you have a guide or somebody usually is with you, somebody who is impartial and supportive. They're not judgmental, but it's kind of like 3D IMAX on steroids. It's, you know, it's extremely realistic and intense, and you see everything that transpired in your life. You feel everything that you felt, but you also can feel everything that other people you affected felt at the time. So if you made somebody happy, if you made somebody miserable, if you hurt somebody's feelings, you feel what they felt. And it's, you know, it really depends on what kind of a life you lived as to how comfortable or uncomfortable the experience is. But that comes up over and over in just about every account that I've seen.
In cases of, and I'm just wondering, you know, what kind of cases, like past life regression kind of cases, near-death experience kind of cases, what kind of where are you finding that kind of material?
Oh, everything. You're talking people who have passed over, who communicate through mediums, we'll talk about that, and people who are under hypnotic regression and asked to experience their death and report on the time in between, we'll talk about it. And people who've had near-death experiences, you know, go through the life review. Like I said, it's all the way through all the literature.
See, I find that really interesting. you don't really hear a lot of people talking about that. Like Daniel Brinkley talks about that quite a bit. And I've heard that that's one of the things that separate like earthbound spirits from people that have, and I'm going to say, have gone to heaven, you know, or have taken that next step so that they can get back on the cycle of rebirth, is that you have to go through that life review process.
I do think that there are souls that don't go through all of that process. And interestingly, I think that a lot of the children that Dr. Ian Stevenson studied may have been earthbound and may not have gone through that process. And that's precisely why they remember so much about their previous lifetime, because part of the process is when you have been in what they call the Bardo realm or the astral plane, you know, whatever you want to call it, and they come back in, there's a forgetting. You know, you forget whatever your past life was. Symbolically, they talk about drinking the cup of forgetfulness or the river or whatever. But that's part of the process. But people who remained earthbound, who never went through that process and find a woman who's pregnant and jump in, which is literally what some of them have described, they didn't go through that forgetting process. They may very well not have gone through the life review process either, for all that I know. And so they still remember.
That's really interesting, because I've always felt like there was a correlation with individuals not going through that life review process being able to let go of their emotional baggage from their previous life. And it would just make me curious, and maybe we can talk a little bit about these cases, but it would just make me curious if those individuals would come through with more baggage, you know, more emotional baggage.
They appear to. They're still very much attached to their previous wife or husband. They're, you know, wanting to go back home to their real parents. They're, you know, wanting to take up their career again and so forth and so on. Yeah, I mean, that's the way I read Dr. Stevenson's cases.
So could you maybe go into detail, you know, about one of his, you know, more fascinating cases, or, you know, a couple of the cases, you know, what kind of work he was doing and what kind of results he was finding?
Well, I don't remember the specific cases too well, but I can go through kind of a typical case.
Okay.
And then I can try to remember one in particular. But a typical case would be that just about the time the child is able to talk, they start saying things like, "You're not my parents. This isn't my home. I want to go home. I'm so-and-so. I live in such-and-such a village. I have two children," whatever. So the parents will then hush them up. As a matter of fact, in rural India, there's a superstition that if children start talking like that, they might not live. So as I understand it, they would put them on a potter's wheel and spin them backwards. You know, they'd punish them to try to suppress this. They certainly wouldn't reward them for it. And at some point, maybe, let's say, an uncle takes pity on the child, and say at age, you know, 4 or 5, and says, "Let's go to this town and see, you know, once and for all." So they go to the town, and the child knows exactly where they are, and they start walking through the streets just like they know the place, which they apparently do, and they go right up to their former house, you know, and if they're allowed inside, they can say, "This is my room," and they can find out, they can say, "This is where the money, where I buried the money," you know, real specific things. There's one case where they said, "Look, my name is written on the inside of this door," and it was, you know, that kind of thing. And if they are presented with a bunch of people, they can pick out their relatives, and if somebody tries to fool them, they're not fooled. You know, somebody will come forth and say, "I'm your mother," and they'll say, "No, you're not. That's my mother. That's my aunt there." You know. And they have the appropriate emotion, and they have the appropriate responses. They will act towards a wife the way that, you know, a man would act toward a wife, or toward a husband. You know, the little girl will act towards the man as she would normally act toward a husband or towards a father, and they'll express those emotions. And they'll also have skills. They'll be able to sing a song or dance a dance or use a piece of machinery from the last life, and they'll know how to do those things. They'll have the preferences that belong to that caste. They won't want their family now in this life, everybody eats meat, but they won't touch meat because in the last life they were, you know, Hindu vegetarian, for example. So there's a whole series of indicators that Dr. Stevenson set out, and some of them he thought had more weight than others, were, you know, more evidential than others. But when you put it all together, but when I interviewed Dr. Jim Tucker, who is Dr. Stevenson's successor, in 2007, I drove up there and set up my video camera and let him talk. Because in the documentaries I'd seen, they hardly let him talk for a minute or two, you know, and like sound bites. And I wanted to just let the man tell his whole story and put it on. So one of the things he told me was they have a case where a little girl remembered 25 names correctly and their correct relation. In other words, mother, sister, brother, aunt, uncle, friend. 25. And to me, at the point, unless Dr. Tucker is a liar, you know, or a very sloppy researcher, if that's true, that a little girl remembered 25 names from a past life, then to me it's a done deal. There's no more discussion. I could go on with this. You know, you've got me on my soapbox, but I feel like this whole argument about is it real or is it not real, it's done already. You know, when the little girl remembers 25 names, I can't even remember 25 names now, you know, of people I know. It's a done deal already. And William James, one of the founders of modern psychology, said that it only takes one white crow to prove that all crows are not black. So this one little girl who can remember 25 names, if you can verify it's real, that's all you need. Just that one case, and we have hundreds of cases.
And I remember, and I think it was on the news, I think I saw it on YouTube, about a little boy who had been a pilot in World War II or something
James
like
Leininger,
that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. James Leininger, yeah.
You know, and I found that was a fascinating case. You know, maybe
that's
you could just share
case.
That story.
Well, I mean, his parents are the best person. That's Sole Survivor is the name of that book, which I highly recommend. Carol Bowman, who I interviewed in my documentary, was the person that the parents brought that case to initially, so she should be credited with finding that case. And she would be a good person to have on someday. But basically what happened is that the exact same thing as what happened in Stevenson's Indian cases, is that this little boy started with nightmares, terrible nightmares. He said, plane is burning, little man can't get out. And he would say it over and over and over, screaming, and they had no idea what the problem was. But it turned out he was, in fact, that man in the plane that crashed in World War II. He remembered his name. I think he remembered his buddy's name, and went on. He knew everything about Corsairs. And the one thing that really struck me, when they first had this piece on ABC's primetime, I think it first aired on, so the interviewer is there, and he's white as a sheet. If I remember, my impression was the guy was scared, you know. So he's interviewing this little boy, and they're walking around, and I don't know. I don't remember if he was there or the parents are relating this, but they're in a museum, and the mother says to this little 3-year-old boy, "Look at the bomb on the bottom of this plane." And the little boy says, "That's not a bomb, Mommy. That's a drop tank." You know, in other words, he knows everything about these planes as a little kid. And that amused me. You know, it really struck me. But what's really phenomenal about that case is it got into the mainstream media. And this, in my opinion, is Carol Bowman's genius, that she is able to get these cases before the public, because there's plenty of them. If you get on my website and you look at all of my little stories that people have sent in, and these people are not lying, you know, and there's evidence in them. In one of the stories on my website, these people have a 5-year-old boy, and he has nonsense words. He'll say these nonsense words. They don't know what they are. You know, he'll point to a glass and say something. And then a friend of theirs who's Greek comes over, and he says, "Those aren't nonsense words. He's speaking perfect Greek." You know, that's a story that somebody sent into my website that's there with the other, you know, 2 pages worth of stories, not all of which have evidence like that, but some of them do. It's not that uncommon, but it's very difficult to get it before the public. So the Leininger case got out. It wasn't censored. And that, to me, is the phenomenal thing. And it's caused quite a stir, because you can't ignore this thing.
Well, especially, you know, what the little kid was saying. And then he did have a friend's name, and they found the guy, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
But
there's a lot of cases like this. If you read Dr. Stevenson's work, and Dr. Tucker's working on a new book, which I believe will have some American cases in it. But this is not uncommon. As a matter of fact, I used to tell people, I dare you, I'll make a challenge. You contact everybody in your social circle, and that means your family and your friends and your coworkers, everybody that you personally know, like a one degree of separation, you know, and see if you can find a case of a child talking about a past life, and I bet you anything you'll find one. It's that common.
Wow. But like any good Western-minded person, you know, the first thing they ask for, but where's the evidence? Can it be scientifically studied? So I'm going to throw that one at you.
Well, Dr. Stevenson is the psychiatrist. He's a pediatric psychiatrist who studied this, applied the scientific method to it. And his scientific method was not laboratory science. It was field science. You know, so when I interviewed Dr. Robert Almeter, who's a philosopher, who's well acquainted, he knew Dr. Stevenson personally, he was well acquainted with his work, he said that it's just as scientific as studying fossils. You know, you can't create a dinosaur in the laboratory until Jurassic Park becomes real. You know, you can't create one, but you can sure as heck find one. And you can sure as heck tell that it wasn't a dog or a pig or a horse. It was definitely a dinosaur, you know. So reincarnation research is the same way. You can find these cases in the field. You can't create them, but you can find them. And if you eliminate all the possible variables, there's no question what's left is reincarnation. There's a few things that are left that people have a little trouble teasing out, like something they call super ESP. In other words, a person has such good ESP that they can know, like they can know 25 names from a past life, like the little girl that Dr. Tucker told me about. That's pretty implausible. And then there's another thing called cryptomnesia, which means that you've read it in a book, or you've seen it in a play, or you've seen it in a movie, and you've forgotten completely about it, but then you start experiencing it as though it was your own memories. Your mind plays a trick on you. Well, that's why Dr. Stevenson studied, you know, little children, because they don't have all these influences. So he eliminated that possible explanation. So the scientific method means that you keep eliminating normal explanations until what you're left with is, you know, either ESP or reincarnation, and then if you can eliminate ESP, you're left with reincarnation, past life memory at the very least. So that's
but
the
what about the five? But what about the 500 again? People that think they were Cleopatra or... I don't know. I mean, you hear these stories that people come back with, you know, and it mostly comes out of doing past life regression or getting a past life reading where, you know, I was this king or queen, you know, these famous people. I had somebody recently that told me that they were the reincarnation of Edgar Casey, and I was like, okay.
Right, I'm familiar. No, I don't want to say a name, but I think I know who you're talking about. Well, if there's 500 people that say they're Cleopatra, obviously 499 of them are mistaken. We don't know about the one, you know, but logically 499 of them are mistaken. It feeds one's ego to have been somebody famous. But here's my take on that. First of all, there's a lot of ways to be famous in the world if you think about it. You could be a famous fireman. You know, you could be a famous, not to say anything bad about firemen, a good friend of mine is a fire chief, but, you know, I mean, you could be famous anything. So so my feeling is that Andy Warhol had it right, that everybody gets their 15 minutes of fame, if I remember his quote correctly. Everybody gets to be famous. So what you're really saying is not, it's not nothing to do with fame. What it has to do with, in my opinion, is cycles. And the cycles are that we don't look at things in many lifetimes, but if you look at things developing over many lifetimes, and I've got an article about mental illness developing over many lifetimes, which I don't know if anybody reads, but in terms of achieving greatness, I think that is a product of several lifetimes. You start out taking lessons, and you get pretty good, and next lifetime you pick it up again, and you do better, and you do better. Maybe, I don't know how many, but I'm guessing 5 lifetimes of really seriously studying something. You get good, and when you get good enough, you've built up enough energy around this thing, you get, just as a natural outcome of the thing, you get fame, you get recognition, because you've built it up to a certain point. And you get, for example, child prodigies would be somebody who's maybe 3, 4, 5 lifetimes into this process, and by the time that you've been focusing on one area for 5 lifetimes, at age 5, you're pretty darn good, you know? So everybody does this. So everybody excels sooner or later in some area. And I think people are instinctively looking for, where is the lifetime that I excel? I don't think fame is, you know, you can get famous for all kinds of stupid things. But what you're looking, what you really mean is, where did I excel? And I think if somebody's giving you a past life reading, for example, they will tell you about the area, the time when you really excelled in something. You know, it's significant to tell you about. So I would rather look at it that way. Take the whole ego trip out of it. Let's assume that you've excelled in certain things over the however many. We're talking hundreds of thousands of lives, probably, in my understanding. So, yes, you have excelled in certain things. And maybe you got famous and maybe you didn't, but probably you did. So let's look for those things.
So you said hundreds of thousands of lives. So there are a lot of people that think, you know, they might have three or four, but there's a big gap between three or four and hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, and this comes from my study of the Eastern sources. From, you don't see this in the Western studies, but from the Eastern sources, the ones that, that I rely on, I get that we've had a lot more than that.
And there's something about information to me that comes out of, you know, I don't want to say Eastern tradition. I'm going to say from ancient traditions, which I think is a very different concept, is that they knew stuff that we did not know. That's
I agree. And that's also, and civilizations are also cyclical. You probably had, I don't know if you have had guests on that talk about ancient civilizations, but these are also
all the time.
Cyclical. And this is not the first advanced civilization by any means, I believe, anyway.
Based on your studies, because it sounds like the ones, the cases that you are familiar with or that we've talked about so far, it sounds like the people have kind of come back right away. You know, the World War II pilot, the little girl. I mean, it's hard to go and interview people if they're dead, you know, or find people if they're dead. But is that a common occurrence in your understanding that, you know, when we die, you know, there might be, I don't know, I'm just going to throw out a number, like a 20-year period, and then we come back? Or can the period of time between lives be longer and more extended? Can there be a couple of hundred years before we decide to come back?
It can be either way, and it depends on a lot of factors, not all of which I, you know, definitely know for sure, but for example, I have heard that if somebody dies suddenly, violently, that they tend to come back much quicker. That's just one variable. There's probably a whole bunch of variables. The other thing is that it's easier to find lifetimes that are fairly recent, so that can skew things a little bit. The ones that we definitely can prove tend to be within the last couple hundred years anyway. You get too much further back than that, and it's not impossible, but it gets increasingly difficult to find information on people. But, yeah, I understand it can be anything from almost immediate to hundreds of years.
Okay, and so I, this isn't meant to be like a joke question, but what about coming back as animals or bugs, which I don't. I mean, do you think that that's possible as well?
Well, except for certain kids that I grew up with. No, just kidding. No, that's a mistake. From what I understand, that doesn't happen. You don't go backwards that way.
All right, well, I'm going to share an experience I had. I mean, so I had this dog, Kiko. She was a poodle. She was the coolest freaking dog. She wasn't a dog. She was a person in a dog body.
Mm-hmm.
And I took her to this class. I was studying at the Berkeley Psychic Institute. And I was supposed to be in class that night, but they were doing like a you and your pet class, and you could bring your dog to class. And so I took her to the class, and, okay, I did get in trouble for going to the class and not going to the class I was supposed to be in at that time. And it was interesting. I was freaking out because whenever they were talking about reincarnation and how, in their belief, you know, animals, you know, especially dogs and certain, like, higher cognitive animals, could be, you know, you could go and what their comment was is if you suffered a death where your body was really traumatized as opposed to coming back into a human body, you would come into a body that interacted with humans but wasn't human. So that was their belief. I will tell you what, Stephen, every time they brought up that topic, she would stand up and stare at the person talking. And then they would stop, and she'd go lay back down. And then they would talk about it again, and she would like she needed to hear this information. It was really bizarre.
Well, there might be exceptions. I mean, there's exceptions to almost everything. So, you know, maybe there are exceptions. There's another possible explanation, and that is that there are animals who have spent a lot of time with people. And, you know, pets that have been pets for quite a number of lifetimes, they're starting to pick up, in, you know, mental impressions from human beings. And so they're going to be a lot more human than an animal you might find out in the woods or something.
Oh, okay. I'll just...
But there could be exceptions, too. I mean, there's exceptions
okay.
to all kinds of things, and I don't believe in locking down things, you know, tight, because no sooner do you, you know, make a dogma than somebody, what is that, bumper sticker, my karma ran over my dogma?
Ran over my dogma, yeah.
Yeah. A little violent, but humorous, nonetheless.
So Dr. Stevens did his work in India. Have there been studies like his done in the U.S.?
I think he was the first. Then there's a Dr. Haraldsson that's in, I always get Iceland and Greenland mixed up, forgive me anybody from there, but from one of those countries. There are some Indian researchers also. He had a number of colleagues that were attempting to prove or investigate reincarnation by the same methods that he was investigating. And Dr. Jim Tucker continues in the same tradition at the University of Virginia. But there are also a lot of people who have attempted to use what I call forensic methods. In other words, they try to prove it, what you'd say, to a legal standard, which are also very strong. Yeah, they're not quite using the scientific method. They're using what you would use if you were a detective. And there is actually a case by a detective, and that's Captain Robert Snow, who wrote a book called Looking for Carol Beckwith. And he was the head of homicide investigation for the city of Indianapolis. And a co-worker who used hypnosis with children, you know, in his department dared him to try a hypnotic regression at a party or something. And he said, you know, okay. And then he wasn't really very serious about it, but she kept bugging him, have you done it yet? And, of course, now his honor is at stake, right? So finally he goes. And he's very honest. You know, I mean, and scientific rigor and honesty are pretty close. So this man is professionally an honest person. You know, he's just going to go for the facts. And he sits there for half an hour, and the hypnotist tries to put him under, and nothing happens except his back hurts. So, you know, he records that, you know, in this account of the procedure, you know, just my back hurt, nothing happened. All of a sudden, he's plunged into this complete, full 3D experience. He's, you know, walking around somewhere in a forest. He knows he's sitting in the chair, but at the same time, it's as though he's literally walking around in this forest, remembering a past life. He remembers three past lives, and one of them is pretty recent, as a painter in the early 1900s. Well, make a long story short, he tracks this down, and he recorded his session. There were 28 points that could be disproved, and he tried for 2 years to disprove the thing. He and his wife both detectives, tried to disprove it, and he ended up proving all 28 points. You know, in other words, he proved it, and the man's credentials are impeccable. He's a detective, and yet I wouldn't say that's the scientific method per se, but it's the detective method. So there's quite a few cases that also meet that standard, including hopefully my own.
Your case?
Yeah, my first book. Yeah, Matthew Franklin Whittier, in his own words, is my own attempt to verify that I was that person. And this is the younger brother of poet John Greenleaf Whittier. And it's a long story as to how I came across this, but I feel that I did, to a pretty strong degree of certainty, prove that I was actually him.
Go on.
Yeah, go on.
I'm sure you could make a long story kind of short.
Well, I certainly can. I mean, we got a little time here. Well, as quickly as I can reasonably go through it, I had a psychic reading many, many years ago by a woman named Patricia Kobler, who worked out of the Inner Space in Atlanta, Georgia. I think she's retired now. But I was convinced that she was genuine from a number of things that she'd said. And one of the things she said was that I had been a woman, a writer, on the West Coast, probably around the 1920s, and that I wrote serials, you know, weekly, you know, installments, and that I was fairly successful. So I would just poke around the Internet looking for women writers that might ring a bell. And I couldn't find any, and then, you know, every once in a while, I wasn't really systematic about it. I would just spend time poking around. And then I ran across this name, the name of Sarah Orne Jewett. and this definitely I knew. I definitely knew that name, and I hadn't studied her in school, so far as I could remember. She's one of the minor New England writers of the 19th century. So she's on the wrong coast and the wrong period of time. But yet I felt, you know, I know this name, definitely. This is familiar. Something about this is familiar. So I wrote to a friend of mine, and this is Jeff Keane, who is in my documentary. He has his own reincarnation case, and he also has a kind of a natural ability for synchronicity. So the coincidences happen, at least in my presence with him and my connection with him, all kinds of coincidences would happen. It's sped up. So I said, this is the guy. If anybody can find what Sarah Orne Jewett means to me, he can. This was maybe 3 weeks after I first ran across this name. So I sent him an email. I said, here's the link to the Sarah Orne Jewett Text Project website, which anybody can look up. And I couldn't find anything that rang a bell to me. It's kind of a hard website to get around. Things are labeled a little funny. So he shot back an email half an hour later. He says, I felt like I was guided to this. I immediately went to this one kind of obscure page where all of her social circle is listed. And if you click on the name for each person in her social circle, it'll come up with a picture, a little something on them. So the very bottom of the list, there's the name Matthew Franklin Whittier, because he was the brother of the poet, and they were personal friends in New England. And so Jeff clicked on this thing, and up comes a picture of this guy, and he wrote me back, and he says, here's the link. He looks like you. You know, I think maybe this could be you. I feel like this is you, if anybody in here is. So I click on it, and I look at it, and I knew the eyes. I knew that was me when I looked into those eyes, and it's a feeling I can't explain, but it's very powerful. It's just recognizing yourself, even though the face is, I would say, about 85% like mine. It's, you know, not exactly like mine, but it's pretty similar. The eyes stay the same, and this is what they say in the literature, that the eyes stay the same from incarnation to incarnation more than anything else. So I knew that was me, so that started me on the road of researching it. And the way I researched it was, should I continue and try to explain how I researched the case?
No, I think they should get the book.
I would love that, yeah. There's more in the book than I can say, and I hate to give people too much because they feel like they've got it, but they really don't. They really need to get in there and see what I actually did.
No, that sounds fascinating. Fascinating. You know, and you said that you could tell that there was a similarity in your eyes and physical characteristics, and that's a common thing that happens?
Apparently it is, but it's not universal. For example, well, Carol Bowman's son remembered being a carrot top, you know, freckle-faced kid, and he remembered being a black soldier in the Civil War. Well, obviously he's not looking, you know, quite the same as he used to. So people can look, like, very different, but they also can look almost identical. So my guess is that people either look opposite or they look identical, one or the other. I don't think there's too much in between. That's just a theory on my part. But just based on how I know, you know, some of the principles operate. But, yeah, Jeff Keane is almost like 100% like his past life person. You can compare the two pictures side by side. I showed it to a girl who was like 11 years old, and she like turned white looking at the two of them when I first was working on my documentary. She blanched, you know, because it's kind of scary, because it really is like, you know, the same. And there's no genetic connection between these families at all, which is a very interesting point, because it means there's some other factor besides genetics. Something else is going on in the development of a human embryo besides genetics. There's some non-physical factor that's directing the growth of the human being and how they eventually come out, because we've got people that look identical that have no genetic connection at all, that just have a past life connection.
But that, you know, brings up a whole lot of other factors. How does that person fit into their family makeup? I mean, I come from a very large family. I have four sisters. And when we were children, my sister and I hung out a lot together, and most people didn't believe we were related. We looked that different. If you put her with the other sisters, you know, if we're all together, you can see the connection, because I look like this one, she looks like her, I kind of look like her a little, they definitely look alike, that kind of thing. You can see how the family tree comes together, if that makes sense. And it would be interesting if, looking at the family tree of these people that have these resemblances to, you know, the families of the past life, you know, if there was any connection, you know, family member to family member, even though it wasn't genetic.
Well, people do tend to reincarnate in families. And there's a book by Carol Bowman called Return from Heaven, her second book, which has some very strong proof cases in it and which deals with this exact topic, showing that people have reincarnated, you know, as their own, like, great-grandfather or so forth and so on, yeah. You have little children that are shown a family album, and they pick out their great-grandfather, you know, and name them and say, that was me, you know, and they've never seen the picture of this person before. They've never seen the album. Never, they didn't know the name, you know, things like that.
Are there other physical characteristics that can come through or is believed to come through from past lives? I mean,
well,
you kind of talked emotional and skills, but what about other kinds of physical characteristics?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because one of the things that I didn't mention about Dr. Stevenson's work is that he studied birthmarks. And he would, first off, he would, you know, he was able to identify a past life through memories and all these other factors that we talked about. But in a certain percentage of cases, the child that was born now had a birthmark that corresponded to, say, his fatal wound from the past life. So if the person was shot in the head, this child has a birthmark, you know, a little one in the front where the bullet went in and a bigger one in the back where the bullet went out. And there's one I remember where there's a shotgun blast. They have the autopsy report with the drawing showing that the person was a young adult and that he was shot in the chest with a shotgun, and you see the pattern of the wounds on his shotgun on his chest from the shotgun. And then you see his rebirth, and the child has a birthmark, and you can compare the birthmark with his past life autopsy report. So he has quite a number of cases like that. So apparently scars can come through. And what that tells me is that it's impressions in the mind which are getting translated into the next physical body.
But that kind of supports the concept that they haven't gone through the life review process, because they would have, in my understanding, let go of that trauma and not brought it back.
That's a brilliant observation. And then if there was a way to test who went through the astral plane process and who remained earthbound, and to see percentage-wise how many of the children that remained earthbound had scars, you might be a high correlation, and that would be something that they might want to study.
Okay, discredit it to me. It's all good.
Seriously, that's, I've never thought of that before. That's a good thought, yeah. Because there's at least one I remember in Dr. Stevenson's books, and the description that the little boy gave was, you know, I died, and I was sitting in a palm tree, you know, up in a palm tree, right? And he was looking down below, and a pregnant woman came walking by, and he jumped into her womb and was born to her. that's his, like, verbatim, you know, and I can't quote it directly because I don't have it in front of me, but that's pretty close. That's what the child said. So clearly he was earthbound, you know. So not all of them describe things like that, but at least some of them did.
But it also would suggest that they went from a traumatized body right into something else, or relatively close in time. Just, well, I mean, it kind of makes me think of like a walk-in. You know, the concept of a walk-in.
Well, the child wasn't born yet. Yeah, there is actually in his cases an example of a walk-in, interestingly enough. But in these cases, the mother still hadn't given birth, and so the child, you know, jumps in at, I don't know at what period in her pregnancy he jumped in. But then the question is, you know, how late can the child jump in and still influence, you know, the physical body? Questions. It's probably a matter of degree.
You know, that just makes me go on this whole, like, little brain tangent, because if it was a soul that wasn't necessarily scheduled to be in that body, you know, what was the relationship with the mother like, the birth mother, you know, because there wasn't an agreement, or father. I mean, because that's something that I see in family dynamics, is that the child that comes through, it's either, you know, the agreement of the mother or the agreement of the father, and then you can tell which one they're going to act like based on that agreement.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
But if this child just kind of jumped the line, it makes me wonder if they act like neither, you know, because there wasn't the agreement to come through from the parents.
That is,
on a knowing level.
Seems to be the child's emotional experience. You're not my parents. They're not really, you know, necessarily, they don't want to even be there because they say, yeah, this isn't my home and you're not my parents. That's what some of them say.
Interesting. Interesting. Little usurpers. No.
Yeah. He basically stole the body.
Hey, bring my little
somebody,
real,
you know,
baby soul back here. If there is a child that is having past life memories, or how can you separate out, you know, a past life memory from imagination?
Okay, well, I'm glad you asked that question, is what they say in, you know, in politics, except I'm actually going to answer it. And I'm back to my colleague Carol Bowman again, because she has set out what she calls four signs, four things to look for that will tell you whether it's just a fantasy or whether it's really a past life memory. And I happen to have them right in front of me. I don't have them memorized. But the first is matter-of-fact tone, she says, which means that the child just sort of matter-of-fact says the thing like it's just a fact and, you know, we just know it. She says it's not a sing-songy fantasy kind of thing. Child says, this is it, you know. In other words, I was a, you know, World War II pilot and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was killed in a crash. And the second one, she says, is consistency over time, which means that they keep saying the same exact details over and over. You know, the little lineage boy didn't change and say he was in a ship, you know, or maybe I was in a train or, you know, or a car when I crashed. He stuck to his story, you know. And his nightmares were consistent, too, unfortunately. Then the third is knowledge beyond experience, which James Leininger clearly demonstrated. He says, that's not a bomb, mommy, that's a drop tank. So that would be an example of that. And the last is what she calls corresponding behaviors and traits, which means that the person, like I said, there might be a child who was a Hindu Brahmin caste who didn't touch meat. So when he reincarnates, he still doesn't want meat. So that would be an example of a behavior and trait that carries over. So those four things, matter-of-fact tone, consistency over time, knowledge beyond experience, and corresponding behaviors and traits.
I had a gentleman, I have a question from the chat room that I'll get to here in a second, but I'm just sharing this. I had a gentleman that come to me at a psychic fair that wanted me to do a reading on his daughter, but not really do a reading on his daughter, but listen to what she was saying, because he wasn't sure if what she was saying was her fantasy or if there was any truth, then they should follow up on it. And so she was telling, I don't remember the details, but she was talking about an earlier life, and she was like 7. But apparently she had been saying the same thing for years and years and years, and fortunately her parents didn't scourge her.
Yeah.
And so I started asking her all kinds of weird questions, because it was like from the turn of the century, late 1800s, early 1900s. And so I started asking her all kinds of weird questions, because she was a woman in that period. And it's like, well, you know, were you wearing a short dress or a long dress? And just things that if you didn't live in that period, you wouldn't know being that age unless you researched. And she was answering all the questions correctly. You know, even when I was throwing decoy questions in there.
Which is what Dr. Stevenson describes, too. They try to fool the kid, and the kid isn't fooled.
Okay, so this is the question that was in the chat room, and I'm not going to read it. I'm kind of going to summarize it. So the question, and this is from my good friend Old Hip, and it says, so are the same souls being recycled over and over again, or are there new souls also being created and put into the mix of souls that are coming to this earth?
Okay, well, it's both. And this I get from the Eastern side of things, my esoteric studies, and not from the Western research, which doesn't really deal with this question. But it's my understanding that the soul progresses up through the whole evolutionary chain. And when it gets to the top, to say the, you know, the great apes, that then there'll be a jump, and that soul will incarnate as a human being for the first time. And once it does that, it continues to reincarnate as a human being. And from there on, you do get this recycling effect.
Okay, that was short and sweet.
Yeah. I mean, it's both, in other words, yeah.
But, I mean, can new souls be created, you know, like new stars are created in the galaxy? Can new souls be created?
Well, I am a follower.
And you can say you don't know.
No, I do. I do know, but I have to sort of. I have to quote my source because I don't know personally. You know.
Got it.
My guru's name is Meher Baba. He wrote a book called God Speaks, and it's all in there. So if you go to Meher Baba's God Speaks, the whole process is laid out in great detail.
About where we come from and the souls. But see, I never even thought about that whole idea about souls being created. You know, kind of like a star being created. You know, it's not something that you even think about ever. Or not me.
Well, according to Meher Baba's explanation, which is it's profound, you know, and I can only do the best I can to do justice to it. But that originally, in the original state, God is just unbroken, infinite existence, calm, you know, like the calm ocean. And then God gets what Meher Baba called a whim. It's not premeditated, but it's the whim to know himself. And as soon as he gets that whim to know himself, it's as though the ocean is suddenly stirred into a million bubbles. And each little bubble is a soul. And then those souls, just that act of having become a soul and being in a bubble creates a little tiny impression of separateness. And that impression gradually urges the soul into higher and higher bodies, which have more and more experience. And so, you know, you start out with, you know, amoebas, you know, or single cell, and you move into plants, and then you move into insects and worms, and then you go up into fish and so forth and so on, gradually reincarnating up through the evolutionary chain. And then once you're a human being, you have this long period of reincarnating, of having all these different experiences to gain wisdom and understanding and spiritual maturity. And finally you get to the point where you're tired of all of this stuff and you want to find God, and you start searching, and that search brings you back in again. And so you retrace your steps consciously all the way back to the source, except now you have full consciousness. So it was consciousness that was developed through this whole process. And through all of us gaining consciousness, this is God coming to know himself.
And then you get to have nirvana.
Yeah, and then it's nirvana. Well, Baba says nirvana is complete vacuum, and instantly after nirvana comes nirvikalpa, which is the consciousness of God.
I had a guest on, and she was talking about ascension, you know, kind of reaching that point where you no longer have to be part of the reincarnation process or, you know, taking on a physical body, which, you know, it's not a question of whether I believe it or not, and but finally I said, but it doesn't sound like we can go through this process in this lifetime. She was
right.
No.
It would take a lot of lives, yeah. Meher Baba said something very interesting. He said if there was sufficient motivation, it could be done in one lifetime. But the inference is that none of us can want it that bad. And Sri Ramakrishna, who I also studied, said, Swami Vivekananda asked him, have you seen God? Swami Vivekananda was a college student, a westernized college student, and he was going around asking all of these Indian sages, have you seen God? And they all hemmed and hawed until he met Sri Ramakrishna. And Sri Ramakrishna says, yes, I see him more clearly than you see me here, but who wants to know God? Because people cry buckets of tears for everything else in the world. But, you know, in other words, you can't get it because you don't want it, badly enough. You know? So it could be done in one lifetime if you really wanted it that badly, but most of us don't, and it takes us, you know, who knows how many lifetimes. Yeah.
Too many to think about. So we have 2 minutes left, and I was going to ask one more. Huh?
Because we get distracted by all these other things that we like better. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So we have 2 minutes left. So I had another question that I thought of, but we'll just have to pick it for a different time in another lifetime. So if somebody wants to see the movie, get copies of your books, et cetera, where would be the best place for them to go?
Okay, I'll say the URL. It's www.ial.goldthread.com.
IALGoldThread.com. Cool. Well, that was very quick. Usually when I open that door up, my guests are like, blah, 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 and the music is coming up.
It's all on the website. It's all on the website. Yeah, everything. It's 13 years worth of website. You know, it's got a lot of stuff in it.
A lot of stuff. Okay, so let me just ask one quick question. We got a minute. So if somebody wanted to find out about a past life, do you recommend past life regression? Do you find that that's a good tool to work with?
I personally think there's two legitimate reasons to use it. One's for therapy under a good therapist, and the other is for legitimate research, but not just idle curiosity, because there are some dangers associated with it.
Okay. And all right, let me ask one other question, follow up. I mean, I have a girlfriend who does the life between life, and I can't for the life of me think of the guy who teaches that, but she's also a counselor, and so she's very good, and I send all of my people that I feel like have past life issues going on that are affecting their life currently, and but do you think it's important to kind of check out the person that you are going to go to or get a referral to someone who is more in the therapeutic area versus the looky-loo, that's what I like to call it, area?
Yeah, yes. That's for sure. It's very important to pick a competent therapist, competent regression.
Because
you can run into something you can't handle on your own. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the music's going to come up here in a second. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on. You were very fun.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right. Say that website one more time.
www.ial.goldthread.com.
All right. Well, Stephen, I will talk to you again soon, and have a great afternoon, okay?
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Stephen Sokolaris. His website, www.ial.goldthread.com, and we will be back with former Governor Jesse Ventura after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.